Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University.
Justice Izhak Englard, former Justice of the Supreme Court of Israel, gives a Dean's Lecture at Yale Law School on law and morality in the Jewish tradition. Justice Englard served on the Israeli Supreme Court from 1997 to 2003.
Thank you very much for the gracious introduction. I can only tell you that I disagreed a lot with Chief Justice Barak when I was in the court. Now it's difficult to disagree what he said about me so graciously. But my major problem today is to make a short survey on a problem that needs hours. I have prepared about more than 40 pages, but I can't talk 40 pages, so I will have to be very short. And I hope to have a possibility also to let you ask questions at the end of my presentation. So I want, it took 15 minutes to introduce me, which is on my expense now. I have to. I go into the topic. Law, morality, and Judaism have in common one thing, namely that their exact meaning is most controversial. And the question of their mutual relationship has been discussed for generations and generations by the greatest minds. The different conceptions of these notions, I repeat, what is law, what is morality, what is Jewish tradition, what is Judaism, are linked to fundamental philosophical and ideological assumptions. And it is therefore most vital at the beginning of my lecture to present, to define clearly the concepts which I'm using in this discussion. And so my first part will be a methodological exposition of the terms which I'm using here. And I hope to do it very shortly. Because otherwise, and you find in the literature about morality and religion, you generally find a lot of logomachy, struggle about words, because people are not exact defining what they are using, what is really morality, etc. It's true that method and personal mentality may ultimately be connected. It's one of the great theses of Kelsen, which you will hear a lot of it, that if you are, let's say, a natural lawyer, I'm a positivist, but being a natural lawyer or a positivist is part of your mentality. That's what Kelsen says about it. So it's part of my mentality, of my genes, if you want to say it, that I came to be a positivist. My basic approach to law and morality is not original in the method. It relies heavily on Hans Kelsen's positivist normative theory, which I will now explain. Law and morality, in the broadest sense, are normative orders, sets of rules of human behavior. They determine that a person ought to behave in a certain manner. As a result, law and morality render possible the evaluation of an actual human behavior. It may be legal or moral if it corresponds to a relevant norm, or it may be illegal or immoral according to respective applicable norm. Now, according to Kelsen, the difference between law and morality resides exclusively in the nature of the respective sanction to be imposed for norm-violating behavior. I will adhere to the Kelsenian distinction between law and morality, relating exclusively to the nature of the sanction, and is not based upon any a priori criterion linked to the content of the norm. Hence, any rule of conduct, now come to definition, any rule of conduct not backed by a threat of socially organized physical coercion is by necessity a moral norm. It's not an evaluation of being good or bad. It's just a statement about the sanction, how is it sanctioned by society. And here now I'm bringing a few different meanings of what morality means. In the first, positive morality, it's the existing social order composed of norms that are not enforced by socially organized physical sanctions. It is constituted by the rules of conduct required generally by society, including etiquette, manners, sexual behavior, and other kinds of behavior that are considered to be socially required. Conduct that violates these norms is sanctioned by social reaction ranging from derision to ostracism. Now, it doesn't mean that it's not effective. You will see that social sanctions, which are not physically enforced, are sometimes more efficient than legal sanctions, which are physically enforced. So it doesn't mean that it's not efficient. It might be very efficient. People are very much afraid of derision, for instance. And if you dress like you are dressing, you are not walking naked in the streets. It's because you are afraid of the social reaction, even though love the law, if the law permits or prohibits it, it's less important. Then second meaning of morality is personal morality. These are the rules of conduct that are laid down by an individual person for his or her own behavior according to their own subjective value systems. These norms are sanctioned by internal feelings of remorse or gratification. There's also positive sanctions, which is gratification. Kelsen describes this process of self-legislation as an individual split of consciousness into two entities: the ego, who wants that the alter ego ought to act in a certain way. And he says it resembles the act of self-observation. It is also, again, very efficient. Very efficient. Now, a third meaning is ethics and justice. There's an additional meaning to morality. It denotes the philosophical inquiry into the absolute good. It constitutes the critical or ideal morality. It assumes the task to answer the question about the correct content of the rules of conduct. In relation to the positive or personal morality, one speaks of ethics. It establishes the criteria for a normative evaluation of the social and personal morality. The ideal rules for the evaluation of the law fall under the notion of justice. Seen from the substance of the rules of conduct, there is no a priori difference between ethics and justice. This means that in principle, every ideal rule of morality could be cast into a legal norm. However, empirically seen, one can discern a difference between ethics and justice. Law, as a coercive order of interpersonal relations, contents itself in practice mostly with less stringent rules than those required by morality that aims at the perfection of the individual. In other words, a just legal solution may be considered ethically insufficient for the personal conduct. Now, in the modern state, the ideology of a modern liberal state is that it contents itself to create and preserve the outer conditions enabling the individual to live up to her own ethical principles. So, in modern liberal societies, there is a difference between ethics and justice because justice is less requiring, exacting from a person less, because if it's not, let's say, if it's not hurting society, then you can, in your own sphere, you can do what you want. Ethics, on the other hand, looking at personal perfection, may prohibit it, even if it's legally permitted. As we will see soon, this ideology of a modern liberal state clashes with the religious outlook. Because in religion, especially in Jewish religion, law and ethics, or I would say Jewish law, is also concerned with the individual perfection of the perfection of the individual. Another fundamental difference between ethics and justice is based upon the specific moral theory of Kant that puts a main accent upon the motivation of the acting person. Accordingly, an act in order to have moral value, to be morally good, must be motivated by an autonomous sentiment of duty. If a man acts out of fear or a threatened sanction, his act is devoid of any moral value. Moreover, if a person acts out of a purely internal inclination, for instance, giving charity to a poor out of compassion, this deed, according to Kant, doesn't possess moral value, since it lacks the required sentiment of moral duty. This rigorous Kantian, which is called in German Gesinnungsethik, which has been translated into different terms, difficult to translate it, if it's the consciousness, if it's the intention of the person who's doing it, has been derided by Friedrich Schiller in an epigram, and I would like to finish this part of Kant's theory at least by quoting you the epigram of Schiller. I'll give it in the English translation, even though I would like to say it in German. Anyway, it starts, "Scruples of conscience. I like to serve my friends, but unfortunately I do it by inclination. And so often I'm bothered by the thought that I'm not virtuous. Decision? There is no other way but this. You must seek to despise them and do with repugnance what duty bids you." Kant's moral philosophy exercised, as we'll see, I'll show you subsequently, a considerable influence upon modern Jewish thinkers. That's why I'm insisting on Kant. He was very influential in the 19th century, also in the Jewish philosophy and orthodoxy, as we'll see. However, Kant's philosophy didn't remain undisputed. One could certainly maintain that even acting out of a sentiment of pure duty may cause an inner feeling of pleasure. Hence, duty and inclination may harmoniously coincide. Now, from a purely normative formal point of view, no interaction is possible between law and morality. I don't want to go into it, because the criterion of validity in every normative system is exclusive by the so-called basic norm. It is possible, I'm doing it very shortly, to create a formal normative relationship by unilateral incorporation. Law sometimes refers us to moral, to ethics. You have it in many laws that contracts who are against morality are invalid. So the legislator is referring you to morality. But morality here is based upon, it is transformed into a legal norm. It's based upon the legal grund norm. It's no more morality, it's law. And on the other hand, morality may refer you to the law, which is the famous dialogue in Plato's Crito between Socrates, who had been unjustly condemned to death, and his disciples, and the discussion with his disciples want to save him from the death penalty. It touches upon this very topic, even if it's very controversial, what was Plato's intention. Some say it was ironical, others say, no, it's real. But I can't go into it. The text, the dialogues are very sophisticated, and their interpretation is a matter of great controversy. In all these cases of incorporation, the foreign norm, quotation marks, derives its validity from the receiving normative order. That's what I wanted. Now, I come to the last notion before I go into the major topic. I'm sorry, but it's important to have at least the method I'm using later. It's the moral decision. It's important to recognize, and here I'm joining my dear friend Guido Calabresi, who is speaking about tragic choices. The essential problems of justice and morality consist in the need to decide between conflicting values. Each value in itself is considered to be legitimate, and the clash in a given situation requires a decision of priority that will have the effect of sacrificing one value for the sake of the other. That's the real problem of justice, of ethics. If everybody agrees, it's consensus, there's no problem. The problem exists, real problem, when you have values which you would like to preserve in a situation, but you cannot do it, and you have to decide. Then you have the predicament of deciding. This I call the moral decision. I'm not going to evaluate it, if it's a good decision, it's a bad decision. It means you have a conflictual situation where there are involved contrasting values, which each, and unfortunately you cannot achieve both all of them, and you have to decide to give preference to one of them. This I'm calling a moral decision. It doesn't mean it's a good decision. It might be immoral in the sense that I disagree with it according to my personal conviction. It's a moral decision because I'm forced to give priority to one value over another. There are many, many examples. I don't have time to go into it. You can read Guido Scalabrese's book where you have many examples of this kind of conflicts where unfortunately moreover, moral decisions are made by any legislator. Every law is a moral decision because you are preferring the value of ordering, of limiting human behavior over freedom of behavior. It's always a problem. Why should you regulate a behavior? So you have a moral decision according to the legislator who says I do it. Moreover, the second factor, which is much more important, every judge who decides he also makes a moral decision because law needs interpretation, and interpretation is a creative act of the just, you know, the judicial process. This is not a new insight. I will see later that the rabbis 2,000 years ago or more, they understood it, that a judicial decision is a creative act of a moral decision. And there is even, let's say, because they were very much aware that the language of the law is never, I would say, universal. It's always ambiguous. So far that the rabbis require a person, in order to be a judge, has to be able to purify the most impure animal. But he must be able, and it says, "Letaheret asheretz al apir Torah," to purify a reptile according to the language of the Torah, which is an impossibility, you think, but he must have the possibility to do it. It means the legal reasoning, the legal tools you are using, the legal concepts enable you to reach an absurd conclusion. And why doesn't the judge do it? And here I come to the second moral decision. A judge, according to the Jewish tradition, has to have Yirat Shamayim, which means the fear of God. He must be loyal to the law, and a secular judge has to be loyal to his own constitution. And even if he has a possibility to reach by purely reasoning, legal reasoning, which is not syllogistic, which is not a logical conclusion, he could reach a different solution, but he has to be loyal to the legislator, to his own constitution, to the, I would say, the fundamental values of the system. So a religious judge, out of fear of God, wouldn't purify, nobody purified a reptile, but he could be able, by the legal reasoning, to reach this conclusion. And it was, I would say, a precondition of his being a judge. The Talmud recounts us that there was a student in Yavne who could give 150 reasons how to purify a reptile, which is specifically said in the Torah that it's impure. 150. We didn't find 150 reasons. There's purely one reason in the Tosafot, in the one of the commentaries, to find one reason how purify. But here we have a rabbi, probably he can give us, maybe you have more than one reason how to purify, but nobody purified ever purified. This is a moral decision. The moral decision, a fundamental moral decision of the judge to be loyal to the law. Now I will go over one further comment on Kant. Kant's idea of autonomy has two dimensions. First, the moral acting out of duty, and which means the basis of cognition of what is unconditionally valid, and secondly, an autonomous cognition of the content of the moral law as the basis of his own personal human reason. That means, according to Kant, Autonomy means two things. One, you don't do it out of inclination or of any reason beyond the duty. And second, that the duty is a consequence of your own moral decision. If it's heteronomous, if it says because the law says it, it's no more a moral law. That's very important because we will see later different. Now I'm coming to the topic. How much time did I use? You say used up a lot of time, but now I come to the law and morality in Judaism, which again I have to do very shortly in order after I have tools elaborated in the preceding my introduction. The religious character of the norms adds a most significant dimension to the relationship between law and morality. Divinity, conceived as the ultimate source of normative validity, is by definition of an absolute nature. For the believer, it constitutes therefore the supreme value, in face of which every conflicted human interest must, in principle, give way. The basic norm in religious system says you ought to abide by the commands of divinity is of absolute and unconditional validity, if the existence of divinity is taken seriously. Now, I have defined the distinction between law and morality following Kelsen's approach on the difference of the kind of sanctions. But in the Jewish law, in the halakha, in the rabbinic Judaism law, religious norms are not only those who are backed by organized societal sanctions, backed with a threat of physical coercion. And I must tell you, I must say here only, contrary to Mendelssohn and a number of Protestant theologians, in Judaism there was never a problem to see that law, religious law, is a coercive order. In Christianity you have some tendency who think that law and religion are contrasting things which you cannot combine. They take Psalm and Mendelssohn also was of the opinion in Judaism that it's, I don't have time to go in much more into it. But Judaism doesn't rely exclusively upon organized societal sanctions. As typical in respect of many other religions, it knows a whole ambit of other sanctions ranging from expression of approbation, censure, to promises of superhuman reward and punishment. It means that the Jewish law, which is called law, and I would say the Jewish normative order, to be exact, includes both moral rules, which means are not physically enforced, and physically enforced rules by a human tribunal. And because the lawgiver is the same, it's divinity, the difference between moral rules and legal rules is fluid, and sometimes it's controversial. I can't go into the details, but you have a whole range of rules which there is a discussion if it's sanctioned physically by a human tribunal or you rely exclusively upon approbation or upon divine sanctions. And the transition is very fluid, so you have some people think, so it means that some moral religious rules are transformed by some rabbis into legal rules. Others think it's not necessary, it's enough to have a divine sanction. And again, for a believer, a transcendent sanction like heavens instead of going to hell is enough for the believer that to behave according to what religion requires, and you don't need a physically enforced sanction, even if under Jewish law you have, can be enforced, even most purely ceremonial acts may be enforced physically. There is one, a few passages in the Talmud that if a person, we just had now the tabernacle feast, so if a person refuses to construct a tabernacle, to, you know, it's a ceremonial thing, you may force him by hitting him until he agrees. Of course, the rabbis were conscious that fulfillment of religious duty by force, by physical force, is not the ideal situation, to say it in understatement. But basically, the possibility, there's another example, you know, the palm, you have a palm on the tabernacle feast. If you don't want to use the palm, you also can be forced, according to the Talmud, by being hit until you agree or until you die. So it's not practiced. It's not practiced today. There are a lot of discussions to what extent physical sanctions should be today. If, according to one of the great commentators on the Maimonides, if you are sure that the person will not abide by the physical sanction, don't start with the physical sanction. It seems to be, you probably know, Meshe Chochma. Okay, now I come to the major topic, the most interesting one. It's the conflict between religion and morality. But this kind of conflict means what I'm emphasizing, between personal morality and a divine order. What happens when according to my value system, think that a certain religious rule runs against my internal conviction? What's the relationship between revealed divine commands and absolute ethical values, which I consider subjectively now? I'm not going into if it's subjective or you can have subjective. In my view, as a positivist, all values are subjective, but don't ask me why. It would take us too much time. Now, in the Bible, we find a series of situations that appear to us a contradiction between a divine commandment and ethical principles. A worldwide famous case of such a situation is the divine order to Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac. There exist many attempts, also in the Jewish rabbinic tradition, to resolve this contradiction. And I'm not going into this case. You can go from, because, why not? Because in the Bible itself, it's not mentioned such a conflict. Abraham doesn't argue with divinity that it's not ethical or it runs against him. So I'm not going into it because it was created and there are many answers to it. You know Kierkegaard, if you know, he wasn't Jewish, but he had a very good intuition because he intuited Midrashic interpretations. What were they talking, Abraham and Isaac, when they went to the, which it's called by those who disagree with the Bible, they called it the binding of Isaac, not the sacrifice of Isaac. He was never killed. But what were they talking among themselves when they went to the mountain and when they returned after it didn't happen? I'm not going, I could talk about it for long. There are many, many interpretations. The first case I see in the Bible, because the Bible doesn't tell us that Abraham had any qualms about it. Now, in the Midrashic, you can find a lot of this kind of interpretation. But in the Bible, you have one allusion to such a conflict, which it's the expulsion of Hagar and her son Ishmael in Genesis. The Bible recounts, and I quote, "It was very grievous in the eyes of Abraham, what his wife told him. And called, God told him to hearken unto the voice of his wife." Take it seriously, you see, he was married. So it says, "Hearken to the voice of your wife," what he then did. Indeed, the religious answer seems to be unequivocal. God's command constitutes an absolute value, in face of which any contrary, merely human value system must give away. Now, an outstanding example of this direct conflict, of a clear-cut, theocentric solution of the dilemma, one finds in the Talmudical account, not in the biblical, but in the Talmudical account of the biblical story about King Saul's tragic failure in dealing with the vanquished Amalekites. And I'm quoting now from the Talmud. "When the Holy One blessed, the Holy One, blessed be he, said to Saul, 'Now go and smite Amalek,'" which was a people which attacked the Jews during the Exodus. "He said," Saul said, the king Saul, "'if on account of one person the Torah said, perform the ceremony of the heifer whose neck is to be broken, which means an act of expiation if you find a dead person, how much more ought consideration to be given to all these persons? Why should I kill all these persons? And if human beings sinned, what has the cattle committed? Why should I exterminate the cattle? And if the adults have sinned, what have the little ones done? Why the children? Why should I kill the Amalekite cattle, property, men and women? The Talmud says, a divine voice came forth and said, a quotation from Ecclesiastes, be not righteous overmuch. Al ti tzadik harbe, those who know Hebrew. So here you have a story of a direct conflict between personal ethical outlook with very good arguments. Why should I kill it? And the answer of divinity was, don't be more just than your creator. Another allusion to an external moral criticism of religious law is made in relation to the halachic rule which discriminates between Jews and Gentiles in respect of the liability for goring oxen. The Talmud recounts that two commissioners sent by the Roman government were sent to Palestine to study the Jewish law. You see, you would say the United Nations at the time that the Roman government was the empire, they sent two delegates to look into the laws. Now, when they studied, and the Talmud recounts, they studied once and twice and three times, they went all over the Jewish laws and they said, we have minutely examined all your law and it is correct, except what you say that if an ox of an Israelite gores an ox of a non-Jew, there is no liability. Whereas if an ox of a non-Jew gores the ox of a Jew, there is liability to pay full compensation. This we don't accept. And then they said, they added very nicely, we will not tell this matter to the government. Another version in the Jerusalem Talmud, it doesn't say they were so graciously had good intention towards the Jewish law. They, when they left Palestine, the holy country, they forgot all what they learned. That's the story, how is it told in the Jerusalem Talmud. So they didn't remember anything, which could also happen to me when I say, yeah, okay. Now the two commissioners mercifully promised that they would not divulge this legal state affairs to the Roman government. The Jewish sources provide different reasons for the legal discrimination between Jews and Gentiles, but the feeling of an ethical problem remains. Why should it be this kind of discrimination? I could go into the Maimonides, who was a great philosopher, the greatest philosopher in medieval times. He gave a very interesting comment. Why there is a difference between Jews and non-Jews? Others say Gentiles are not the Gentiles from today. These are the Gentiles, idolatrists only, etc. There are a lot of arguments. But here you find an expression of an ethical problem. The truth is, however, that until modern times, the problem of a conflict between Jewish law and different moral systems didn't seriously engage Jewish religious thought. The theocentric outlook, combined with a strong sense of submission to legitimate religious authority, provided the necessary answers to possible critical moral objections of individuals. An interesting and influential attempt to provide the theological foundation of the precedence of divine law over human reason was undertaken by great Rabbi Löw of Prague, the Maharal, who was said to have created the golem. But the story of the golem came only a long time after Maharal was dead. I'm not, you know the golem, it's the artificial human being who was created by him. But he had contacts with humanistic thoughts and he met Rudolf II, the emperor. And in his view, the divine law of the Torah is the expression of the absolute intellect, which is far superior to human reason. That was his answer. So he said, whenever you find a rule in Jewish law which you have problem from your personal reason, then you have to assume that your personal human reason is lower, inferior to divine, which is much greater. The Maral's writings and this idea exercised an enormous influence upon important trends of Hasidism, and the idea that divine reason, upon which Jewish law is based, is far superior to human reason, has a special place in Hasidism. It has been underlined by many Hasidic authorities that it's your problem. Divine reason is absolute. But if you have a problem, don't. And then I would add another dimension to it, namely that there is human reason is suspect. I would say, like in postmodern thought, don't rely too much on human reason. And in Hasidism, especially in Hasidism, human reason is, I would say, a little bit the activity of the Satan. And it's much more preferable what the Catholic Church, which has a very similar problem, called Sancta Simplicitas. The Sancta Simplicitas, which is, I'm not speaking about the famous wording of von Jan Hus, when an old woman brought a piece of wood to burn him alive, he said Sancta Simplicitas. That's an anecdote. If it's true, I don't know. But Sancta Simplicitas, this kind of innocent belief in divinity, comes from the Franciscan. And the Franciscan, Franciscus d'Assisi, said that human reason is confound, the Sancta Simplicitas confounds human wisdom. It's much more important if you have an innocent belief in divinity and don't rely too much on human reason. Which again is very postmodern, I would say. If you want to go in, reason has got very suspicious in the last years. I'm not saying anything, but I'm saying it. That's one of the tendencies why in the ultra-Orthodox, if you come with human reasons, human ethics, you won't get much, I would say, the acceptance. Because human reason is something which the Satan is behind it. Yeah. Now I'm coming a few comments. Personal morality cannot be excluded, even in Judaism. And during the judicial process and the moral decision as I defined it, ethical values of personal ethics, personal morality, penetrates into the legal decisions of the rabbis. It means even if it's not directly, you say directly there is a contradiction, but indirectly there is an influx of personal ideology in the legal process. And I can give you many, many modern examples where you can see that the difference in Jewish law, I would say, is characterized by dissent, by controversies. The whole Talmud is full of controversy. And today also, in many major issues, you have different opinions which you can easily see that they are based upon personal moral ideologies, which might be religious. All are religious, of course, but they penetrate into it. And I can give you only a few examples. That's bioethics, artificial insemination, the huge discussion among the rabbis today, if it's permitted, in what sense. And you can see that behind the actual decisions of the rabbinical authorities, there are personal ideologies, religious ideologies, but personal ideologies. The same is true if you take Zionism or the State of Israel. If you are ultra-Orthodox with anti-Zionist, your decisions will be influenced by this ideology, and I can give you many examples. I myself have done an article on the problem of giving back territories to the Arabs. Rabbis are divided on this issue, and you can easily see that the division of opinion, the dissent, stems from personal ideology. How do they look upon the Jewish state? It doesn't mean they are not religious outlooks. They are religious outlooks, but the personal and personal ideology penetrates into it. I come to the, I have still a few minutes, the motivational aspect. According in Jewish law, the required motivation of fulfilling a divine order, a mitzvah, a precept, a religious precept, should be heteronymous. It says in the Midrash, in relation, for instance, to the prohibition of pork, don't say, I have no desire for it, but say, I want to eat pork, but what can I do? My Father in heaven has ordered it to be prohibited. This is a quotation. So the motivational aspect has been emphasized by Maimonides, and I'm a heathen, I'm quoting from his Mishneh Torah, who accepts the seven commandments and observes them scrupulously, is a righteous heathen, and will have a portion in the world to come, provided that he accepts them and performs them because the Holy One, blessed be he, commanded them in the law, and may know through Moses our teacher that the observance thereof had been enjoined upon the descendants of Noah, Noahide laws, even before the law was given. But if his observance of these rules is based upon reasoned conclusion, upon his reason, he is not deemed to be a resident alien, which has a privilege, or one of the pious of the Gentiles. And now there's a difference of opinion if it says, but one of their wise men and not one of their wise men. We don't know if, what's the original text. Now, it has to be heteronymously. If a person abides by the religious law because it's based upon his own reason, it's not a religious act. Maimonides, this passage from Maimonides angered very much Spinoza. It troubled very much Mendelssohn, also Hermann Cohen, which I later wrote. Unfortunately, I don't have time to go into the discussions. Mendelssohn asked the rabbinical authority, what do you think about this Maimonides? Why should it be that a person who is doing it out of his reason, why shouldn't he be like a very good one? Why should he be considered to be defective, etc., etc.? Now I'm coming to the last issue. I think I have a few minutes. You're giving me a few minutes. The religious responses to the challenge of modernity. Because what I'm until modern times, where I said the problem wasn't so. It didn't occupy very much the Jewish thought, but beginning from Kant and the 19th century, the movement of enlightenment, which also was in Judaism, accompanied with a desire for emancipation, confronted the Jewish tradition with a scale of values conceived to be based on reason and possess universal validity. The clash between the system had far-reaching effects on the Jewish people, and the issue of Jewish ethics continues to be of great actuality. In the early 19th century, Judaism divided into different religious movements, each adopting its own views about divine revelation and the religious legal tradition. Influenced by Kant's moral philosophy and his notion of religion, the movement of liberal and progressive Reform Judaism subjected the whole legal tradition to moral criticism. As a result, the heteronymous foundation of traditional rabbinic halakha was abandoned, and the autonomous moral understanding of the individual believer received absolute priority. By assuming the comprehensive moral rational nature of the Jewish religion, Reform Judaism, which is movement today, excluded a priori a possibility of any conflict between religion and morality, because morality has, in the Kantian sense, precedence over the religious tradition. So the Reform movement separated from the traditional Orthodox Judaism because of the clash between morality and the legal tradition. Another movement in the middle of the 19th century, the so-called positive historical Judaism, separated itself under the spiritual leadership of Frankl from the Reform movement. And Frankl's ideas exercised a decisive influence in the United States, where the movement is today known and active under the name of conservative Judaism. This trend inside religious Judaism accepts in principle the binding character of traditional halakha. However, influenced by Savinist German historical school, it attempted to differentiate inside religious law between essential fundamental elements and those that are merely historical contingent. And that's their way to cope with the problem of positive morality and personal morality when it comes into conflict with traditional religious rules. They changed the rules with the means of historical research and the means of the legal tools of the halakha itself. So contrary to the reform movement, who rejected the binding character of the halakha and the unique divine revelation and give precedence to personal moral in the Kantian sense, Kant disliked Judaism. Because he said it's heteronymous, he said Jewish religion is not a religion at all. And you have a huge Jewish literature, because they were very much concerned with Kant's ideas, who said that Jewish religion is not a religion at all. It's a statutory, I would say it's a kind of a legal political system, it's not a religion. I don't want to go into all the literature about Kant and his relationship to Judaism, but it deeply influenced the Reform movement, who were, according to Kant, transformed the Jewish religion into a Kantian concept of religion, which is personal morality. The conservative movement relies upon the assumption that the scientific historical analysis of the incontestable changes in Jewish law throughout the ages would be able to reveal the reality of purely historically conditioned value judgments. Let's say the Gentile discrimination between Gentiles and Jews is a historical fact which can be changed by legal tools, and it was historically conditioned. I would say that the idea, very shortly, that I have some qualms about the understanding between legal and historical research. In my view, historical research cannot give you normative conclusions. Normative conclusions are always subjective, based upon ideology. It's not a scientific. Even if you find it, something was changed, doesn't mean that you have to change it again. The idea that you have changed it again, you have to change it, is not a consequence of a historical method, but is a consequence of your ideology. That's my comment on the idea that historical research can be. Now, the hardcore of Jewish Orthodoxy didn't experience any real moral dilemma, and the more conscious of the problematic relationship, and I come to the end soon, between Jewish tradition and modern ethics were the members of an important center of Neo-Orthodoxy, which was created in the Jewish community of Frankfurt under the guidance of Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, 88 to 1888. And I would like to finish by one of the modern Orthodox thinkers. How does he view the problem? Orthodox, not conservative, not reform, but Orthodox. And it's Yeshaya Leibovitch, which 1903 to 1994, a provocative Orthodox scientist and thinker, professor. I knew him very personally, very well. Many discussions with him. And I'm finishing with a quotation before I make a conclusion by him. I'm quoting, "Ethics, he's Orthodox, neo-Orthodox, and he's now coping with the problem of ethics, universal values, and Jewish religion. Ethics as a value by itself is a downright atheistic category. Only one who considers man to be the ultimate end and the supreme value, that means one who puts man in the place of God, can be a moral person. One who conceives man as a creature that is not God, but merely an image of God, and one who has a religious approach, cannot accept ethics as a standard and criterion. Ethics has only one of two meanings. Ethics, one, direction of man's volition according to his perception of the truth of reality. This is the ethics of Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, of the Epicureans and Stoics, especially of the latter, and in modern philosophy of Spinoza. Second, ethics is the direction of man's volition according to his perception of duty. This is the ethics of Kant and the German idealism. But in the Shema prayer, it reads, Numeri, and that you seek not after your own heart. This is the rejection of Kant. Seek not after your eyes. This is the rejection of Socrates. Hence, there are no moral precepts based on perception of reality or perception of duty. There are only the commandments of the Creator. Of all 48 prophets and 7 prophetesses who were active in Israel, none ever addressed him or herself to the human conscience, the latter being very suspect to be an expression of idolatry. It is no accident that the term conscience is not found in the Bible and had to be invented in the later Hebrew. It's true. The modern notion of conscience is an invention which we didn't have from the Bible. The direction of by conscience is a pronounced atheistic concept. The halakha, the Jewish law, as a religious institution, doesn't tolerate the category of ethics, and there is no need to state that it does not tolerate the utilitarian foundation, neither from the standpoint of individual welfare, nor from that of the nation or society of the like. Now, Leibowitz leads the theocentric foundation of Judaism to its extreme consequence. Between religion and human morality, there is an irreconcilable contradiction. In the spirit of Leibowitz, you would say, the greater the sacrifice of human moral values, the greater is the religious significance of the obedience toward the divine law. As I have shown elsewhere, now, Leibowitz said himself was a little bit contradictory. I have no time to go. I would like to make the conclusion, my conclusion. The fundamental issue in modern Judaism is normative. Should current moral consideration affect the shaping of Jewish law? Should Jewish law respond in an affirmative sense to new moral attitudes and values? Any attempt to answer these crucial questions puts the believing Jew to his ultimate test. It requires to him to determine his position before the Creator in the light of a binding tradition. He will have to ask himself if he's striving for the adaptation of religious law to his personal convictions and feelings of morality is not an act of human conceit and insubordination, manifesting oblivion of his real position before God. There cannot be an objective criterion for the correct answer since it requires a value judgment. But by the honest admission of the existence of such a grave dilemma, the way is open for a radical re-evaluation of current moral trends. No doubt, this theocentric approach in its extreme form contains danger of religious fanaticism and of fundamentalism, leading to a complete rejection of modernity. Such tendency can be discerned also in some circles of contemporary Jewish orthodoxy. Theocentricity in itself has no attraction nor even relevancy to a non-believer. Nevertheless, by its appeal to traditional values, its claim to universality, and its inherent skepticism of current claims of rationality, it is able to fulfill a vital critical mission in modern culture. Moreover, a deeper knowledge and understanding of this approach is a prerequisite for a fruitful communication between secular and religious cultures. Such an exchange of ideas is vital, both for the peaceful coexistence in a multicultural society as well for the relations between states. Thank you.